Yes, I'm next. This is the 40th camp out. It would have been the 41st, but we didn't have it during the COVID year. I was talking to a girl in line on Sunday while we were waiting, and she said, well, the first year we came, there weren't many people here, and we figured out that was the reason we didn't have it. That's why there weren't many people. A bunch of you did come, but it wasn't under the auspices of the Prince Road congregation, hence not a real camp out. So this is the 40th, and it would be interesting to me to see the hands of the people who were here for that first camp out in 1984. That's a substantial percentage of the people who were here. Thank you very much. That's a substantial percentage. On that first Monday of the first camp out, we counted at the time of the devotional in the morning, and we had 97 people at that first camp out. It was a little different atmosphere back there because you got to see everybody every day, and you could talk with everybody every day. In fact, on the first day, I combined the junior high class and the high school class because we only had one person in the junior high class. That was Alana Bam. She was in there by herself, and wow, one-on-one is a good teacher-student ratio because she might enjoy meeting with other students. So you can see how things have changed in that way. We didn't have any microphones. We didn't have any loudspeakers. We divided the adult class each day and sent half of them away over the hill with a couple of teachers. Two teachers taught in the place where the half of the group remained. We had six teachers that first year, two for each group of the adults, and then at the break, the teachers switched places and the classes remained in the same place for the adults. Had a junior high class and a high school and college age class, so all the six teachers were occupied each day. And of course, we had younger classes just as we do now. On the Tuesday of the first camp out, in the process of making the announcements at the end of the morning session, I stated that the afternoon had been set aside to visit the Johnson shut-ins. And in trying to be funny, I said that we should all do our Christian duty and visit the shut-ins. So after an hour and a half trip up there and a few hours there, on the way back, one man told me, well, that certainly wasn't what I expected. I only found out that night at the Watermelon Beach that some believed that we were actually going to a rest home. So I was quite chagrined. Nobody had a cell phone back then, and nobody had... Or if you did have a personal computer, there was no internet connection, so it was much different in being able to predict weather. Wednesday morning, we had a very hard rain, and then it rained off and on again throughout that day and night. There were no lodges, there was no shelter houses, a much more rustic campground than it is now. There are more buildings now at Discovery than some towns that I visit from time to time. But back then, it was very rustic, very little there. The office compound wasn't even all there. There was an office, but it wasn't really what it is now. So we managed to have the devotional outside on that Wednesday morning, but right at the end of that, the rain came in a big way, very hard. So we squeezed into the office. I'd gone in there earlier and rearranged the furniture, and a whole bunch of us could get into the office to have a class, albeit we were standing mainly. I taught a children's class under Wilford Landis's canopy that was attached to his camper. Another class met in Dale Harrington's tent, and another class met on the porch in front of the office, and we got along just fine. I got soaked to the skin trying to arrange all these classes, but it was summer, so it didn't matter. That Wednesday night, since it was still raining, we met in the Christian Church Pavilion, which was in back of the Christian Church. You know that place in West Inlands? Many of you know it. Church of Christ is still in the front, I believe, but it's known as a Christian church now in West Inlands. It was like a big shelter house in back of it. Each of us six teachers made a six-minute talk. The rain blew in the pavilion a few times, and you could hear people's lawn chairs steaming on the floor to get out of the rain, but I didn't hear complaint number one about Valley. I rode over there with Jim Basinger because of the parking issue, and I remember pushing his car out of the mud to, so he could leave and a few others so everybody could get out there. What good times. On Thursday, the weather was beautiful again, as it was all week except Wednesday. We had a canoe trip in the afternoon, and that night we had what Dave and Christy Evans called Friendly Feud Night. It was based on the Family Feud. It had similar rules, but it was Friendly Feud, and they did an excellent job on that. They had done the same thing previously in California, so they were experienced with it. And if you know the rules to Family Feud, you know how it goes. You have to give an answer that somebody, that enough other people have given in order to be able to win. And we built through that game up to the finals. There was one brother who was, I would say, a prominent evangelist. He's no longer with us, but he was on a team that was in the finals of the Friendly Feud. So when the pressure was at its peak, this brother was asked to name a mother and son from the Bible. I said, a mother and son from the Bible. He paused a moment, and then with that penetrating, self-assured, deep bass voice, the brother intoned, Eve and Adam. Yes, there were howls from the audience. And the brother let two or three seconds slowly pass before he realized, and then a look of horror came over his face as he buried his head in his hand. Interestingly, very interestingly, I had seen that same brother make a very similar gaffe at Martinsville, Indiana in 1971, also near a campfire. It's just fascinating. Is there any group of people more interesting than the church? I don't think so. In fact, I think that same Friendly Feud night was the night that another evangelist's wife told us all, as seriously as she could, that a sheep is a female goat. Must have been something in the water that night. On Friday at the devotional, we had 106 people. That night we had the talent show. If we were at the campground, I could show you a little draw where there used to be a stage down the hill. And the talent show went very well. There was actually some real talent at that first day. People had prepared well. And then on Saturday morning at 8 a.m., we had our farewell breakfast, and everybody took off for home. It was a good time. We didn't know if we would ever do it again or not, but it was a good time. My assignment for this evening is a look back at the church in the last 40 years, from the viewpoint of an evangelist, and a prognosis on what the church needs to be on guard for during the next 40 years. And of course, I can only speak to my own personal experience, which is by no means universal. What about the church in Australia, for example? I know virtually nothing about that. Even what about the church in North Dakota? I know very little about that. So I'll tell you some things that I think I do know. But it comes from my perspective, which may not be identical to yours. You may have a different take. And please bear in mind that old men's memories are notoriously faulty. During that first campout, we had a lot of people who were here of the World War II generation. The war had only been over for 39 years. Many of that generation had been raised in country congregations. Many of them had gone straight off the farm into the service. They had come back and married and moved to the cities for work and either met with existing congregations or they started new ones. And they helped to establish the template for many of the things that you and I think about when we think of church assemblies. Obviously, what we do comes from the New Testament, but the Lord did not often tell us the specifics of how to do things. How do you do the Lord's Supper, for example? What are the actual details? These are the people that helped establish that template for how we do things that many of us think of as normal. When I think of those old guys of my parents and my grandparents' time who came through the hard times of the Depression era, I think of that statement that you may have heard. Hard times make hard men. Hard men make soft times. Soft times make soft men. soft men make hard times. And you can say in your own mind where we may be on that scale. Today, that World War II generation is almost entirely gone. And when we lost those people, we lost more than just people. We lost their way of looking at things. We lost their values. We lost their example. We lost those things, I say, except as they linger in our memories and in their influence on us. This was brought home to me in microcosm a couple of years ago out in Bakersfield, California, because I hadn't been there in almost exactly 20 years. So I went in there in 2002 on a Sunday morning, and my first impression was of missing all the older people that I used to know. I could probably name off a dozen or more of them, and many of them would be people that some of you knew, because so many had passed on since I had been there. But then as we went through the assembly, I started noticing how so many of the younger ones had stepped up and were fulfilling their roles, as they should. And I found that a very heartening cause for optimism. And that is happening in many places. I asked in my assignment, looking back at the last 40 years, what is the church doing right? In what areas has the church remained solid in its teachings and practices? Well, from my perspective, I think that in most of the teachings and practices, we have remained solid over the past 40 years. And I think we're even handling our interpersonal relationships better than we used to in many, many cases. With your kind indulgence, I need to go back a little more than 40 years, because to me, 40 years is like last Tuesday. But I need to go a little further back. When I was a boy, there were sometimes serious fistfights between men in the church, sometimes right in the meeting houses. Didn't happen a lot, but it happened. It may be hard for some people to believe, and I'm glad it is, but it certainly happens. I remember one time in my home congregation, one time the elders put hands on a man to put him into a car so that the elders could have a conversation with him that they needed to have. They put him in the middle of the front seat of the car. Cars used to be big boats at that time. One elder on one side, another elder on the other side, so the guy couldn't get out, and the rest of the eldership in the back seat, and they had their conversation. Sometimes there was just a little more male physicality than we might expect in our time. I think the term for it these days is toxic masculinity, I'm not sure. At Raymer, where my mother grew up in the church, Junior Gorham, one of her distant cousins, told me that as a young man, if he missed church for a couple of weeks, then when he came back, he'd be sitting there on the aisle, and one of the old elders would come and take a hold of his ear and just twist, and then Junior was virtually on the floor. Doesn't seem like a good way for people to want to come to church, but that's the way it was done. And that's the way society was. People didn't think too much about this. It was not unusual in those days for a father to say to his son, "You do that again, I'll knock your teeth down your throat." Even my mother, gentle woman that she was, and many of you knew her pretty well, but I can remember my mother saying to me on several occasions, "You do that again, I'll slap you in the next Tuesday." It was just the way the society was at the time. My 8th grade science teacher knew where these pressure points are, and he only needed one. He could grab a hold of that and literally put a student on the floor. That was the way he controlled the class. My wife's homeroom teacher, when she was in junior high, did the same thing, and she was a woman. This was not uncommon at all. In many classrooms, the paddle hanging on the front of the room where everybody could see it and everybody could be reminded of what it was going to be like if you disobeyed in any way. Nobody thought much about it. Kids got paddled or swatted every day. It was just part of life. Now, when it comes to the church, of course, the Lord's apostle said that the servant of God must not strive, but be gentle unto all. I believe in corporal punishment in the home, but the church is another matter. So I'll put in the words of a sister that I respected a great deal. Some of you knew Mary Estes, and if you didn't know her, I wish you had. She was such a gracious lady. Mary was in the church at Martinsville, Indiana, and she knew her way around the church all her life. Her father served as an elder and later as an evangelist. Her husband served as an elder. Her son served as an elder. Her granddaughter is married to an elder. By the way, her granddaughter's name is Renee Griffin. I don't know if she's here or not, but I know a lot of you know. surrounded in the church all her life. She's passed on now, but I have a lot of respect for her. And she told me 30 years ago, we're more civilized than we used to be. And that's right. That's right. It was true when she said it, and it continues to be true now. So I think we're handling our interpersonal relationships, we're handling conflict resolution better, by far, than we did in some previous times. My assignment continues, in what areas has the church slipped or moved the ancient boundaries? Well, in earlier days, I think there was perhaps among us generally more of a sense of being outsiders from the world and the importance of being unspotted from the world. I think maybe as we became more affluent, we somehow lost some of that sense. When I was in public school, I was given notes to my gym teacher so that I didn't have to dance during the PE class. It was just considered wrong in my family. I never questioned it. I knew that it was considered wrong in my family and in the church as I knew it to engage in dancing. I didn't ask about going to the prom because I knew I wasn't going. And I didn't resent that. I just knew all my life I wouldn't be doing things like that. There was a lot of emphasis as I was growing up on not engaging in mixed swimming. There was a lot of emphasis on modest clothing and the specifics of what that meant. Going to movies was entirely forbidden. My dad, as a matter of fact, as a young man, went forward at 26th and Spruce in Kansas City because he had gone to see a movie, and he was repenting of that, so he went forward and publicly confessed. I never knew my parents to go to a movie during my lifetime. We didn't have playing cards in our house. Living a life unspotted from the world was heavily emphasized, and what that meant specifically was spoken about a great deal. A high percentage of sermons at least touched on that, and many sermons were about that in their entirety. There were specifics that were legislated out of generalities in the scriptures. Whether one should roller skate in a roller rink was questioned. Playing pool, even in a brother's basement pool table, was questioned. One time I was playing pool with an evangelist of my father's generation in a brother's basement, and as this man queued up his next shot, he said, you know, I used to preach against this. It's very interesting, these changes that took place. My dad really didn't want me to play pool. When some folks in the congregation got a pool table in their basement, he relented, but he didn't like it. He said, all right, the first you ever go to a pool hall. This was the atmosphere. Tom Dennis wrote a little booklet around that time called To Heaven Down View. Some of you may have seen it. I asked Tom one time when it was that he put that out, and he didn't know for sure. He couldn't remember. But I know from the text that it was published after 1958, and probably not long after 1958. It probably came out about 59 or 60. I remember that Tom being at 63rd and Blue Ridge in Raytown, where I grew up, my home congregation. And he saw me take one of those off the pile because they were being given out for the younger people of the congregation. I was not even 8 years old, so I took one. He saw me take it, so he slipped up behind me in the seat where I was sitting in the front row there at 63rd Street. He said, now you may be. I don't know. You may be a little bit too young for that to read it quite yet. So, of course, then if I went straight home that night and read every word. Just to see what it was. But if you want a flavor of those times, you might want to look at a copy of that. There are still some of them around. I'm glad Tom wrote it. I know at the time some of the older people didn't like what he said about love making via the rail system, statements like that. But Tom was trying to help the youth of the church have a good Christian life, and I appreciate that very much. And I do think, by the way, that the homeschooling movement has, to some extent, re-emphasized being unspotted from the world in our time. I am asked in my assignment, how did or is the church handling the COVID trial? Well, it handled it very differently from one place to another, often depending on geographical location, local laws and regulations and so forth. Other factors were involved as well. As you all would agree, I think, the COVID issue became politicized very early. And it just was interesting being in different parts of the country during that time, how the political environment affected how the church responded or was able to respond to the COVID issue, sometimes for legal reasons. In the Chicago area, for example, or in the Los Angeles area, it was different from rural Kansas. I went to congregations during that time where it was like nobody ever heard of COVID, and I went to other places where it seemed like the mask wearing would just go on forever. As elders had to attempt to accommodate the desires and the fears of everybody within the congregation, elders, while still, of course, fulfilling the New Testament mandate, but they had to take into account everybody's view of it in their congregation. It wasn't easy to be an elder during that time. One man said, "You appointed me as an elder 4 months before COVID. Thanks a lot." But overall, I think we did about as well with it as we could. I think the COVID thing functioned as a reset for many congregations which had been stuck with traditions they didn't particularly want anymore, but for various reasons they found difficult to change. But the pandemic forced some change. It forced some rethinking. And I believe, too, that this process is still ongoing and has yet to completely shake out. But I have every confidence that the brethren will figure out what is best for their own congregation in their own circumstances. COVID just helps some people rethink what they're doing and why. I am asked on that issue of the COVID, did it strengthen or weaken the brotherhood? Remember, the Lord wants the church to be built out of gold, silver, and precious stones and not wood, hay, and stone. Obviously, some people quit during the COVID times. If you wanted to quit the church, it was as good an excuse as any and better than many. But it did get congregations to rearrange some traditions that had, in some cases, become rather ossified. COVID pushed the reset button for us, and I think they were better off for it. I just trust the brethren to figure it out over time. So strengthen or weaken, I'm not really sure I could say that it did either one, but it did change some of our thinking. I also ask, is the divisive spirit of our country creeping into the church? Well, to some extent, of course, that's to be expected to happen. We just need to remember that historically we have faced this type of thing over and over again a number of times, and sometimes we faced it when it was much more severe. Hoping to put this into a little historical perspective, I want to go back even further in time, before my time or yours, so we won't be maybe as emotional about it when we think about it. I'll just let one family serve as a microcosmic historical example from the past. Alexander Campbell's family on the issue of slavery was quite divided, up to and including the time of the Civil War. I don't know if you realize it, but the church was the only significant religious entity in the United States that did not split as a national body at the time of the Civil War. We could name a number of other groups, but they all split. But the reason they split was because they had a national headquarters. The church, of course, the Lord's church, did not formally split as a national body because our only headquarters is in heaven, and you can't split heaven. But we were divided over the issue of slavery. Make no mistake about that. There was an incident at Bethany College, which had been started by Alexander Campbell. This happened in the fall of 1855. The majority of the Bethany students were from the southern states, but a significant number were from the northern free states. And some of the northerners began agitating over the issue of slavery. There is no Church of Christ meeting at Bethany, sadly, any longer. But the building is there. The old building is still maintained. Some of you may have been there and gotten inside of it. This was in use at that time in 1855, and in the Sunday evening sermons at the Bethany Church House, students both strongly defended and vehemently attacked slavery, sometimes during the same meeting. This led eventually to the dismissal of 5 students and the voluntary departure of 5 others. There was a Canadian abolitionist student who preached a Sunday evening sermon in which he directly condemned American slavery and condemned the morality of any church that would support it. During his sermon, 20 or 30 members of the congregation angrily got up and left the building noisily. Somebody broke a window from the outside. People were hitting the windows with sticks. Some of them got under the building and were banging on the floor from underneath the building, and they continued outside talking loudly to disrupt the meeting inside until the end of the service. When the speaker and those who sympathized with him left the building, they were verbally threatened with consequences. The speaker later received an anonymous note threatening him. Campbell condemned all discussion of the slavery question, either for or against. But Northwestern Christian University, so-called, in Indianapolis, which was founded by abolitionists, including Obed Butler, after which the university was eventually named, and most of you who are from Indiana will recognize it by that name, still call Butler University today. I've been there occasionally to look at some of the Sommer stuff that they have. And the Butler University, as we would call it now, accepted some of those expelled students from Bethany without even consulting the administration at Bethany. Alexander Campbell was outraged by this. It was a very emotional issue for the graduate. There didn't seem to be any neutral ground. You were one side or the other. Alexander Campbell's own family was sharply divided over these issues. His pro-Union nephew, Archibald Campbell, was a major leader in the movement to create West Virginia. Remember, they took a piece of Virginia off and made it into West Virginia in opposition to the Confederate state of Virginia. Campbell lived in Virginia until it became West Virginia. He's on that little piece of West Virginia that sticks out between Ohio and Pennsylvania. And his younger sister, Alexander Campbell's younger sister Jane and her husband Matthew McKeever operated an important station on the Underground Railroad, helping runaway slaves to get north or to get here out of the country. But most of Campbell's family were strongly pro-secession and pro-slavery. His secessionist son-in-law, W.K. Pendleton, became the de facto editor of the Millennial Harbinger as Campbell's powers declined. Campbell's wife and children were all bitter secessionists. And when Alexander Campbell's two living daughters, because most of his 14 children died during his lifetime, when his two living daughters and his youngest son learned that Campbell had voted against Virginia's secession in the statewide referendum in May of 1861, they angrily accused their father of a terrible duplicity in betraying the Southern cause. Alexander Campbell's oldest son, Alexander Campbell Jr., was the bitterest of all rebels. He served as a colonel in the Louisiana cavalry. And after the war, he only escaped a conviction of treason and time in prison because President Johnson pardoned him. These deep wounds right within Alexander Campbell's family were open and they were painful. Within 6 months of his son's pardon, Alexander Campbell was dead, suffering from these wounds. So the division we face in our time is not a new thing. This has always gone on periodically through the years, and sometimes it's been much more striking, much more bizarre than it is in our own time. We need to think in terms of that historical context. We've always been periodically facing these kinds of problems, and the solution to them is to love one another. So simple. Just love one another. Aren't we work at loving one another? And you know it's not always easy. But it's only in a context of love that we can build that relationship so that we can ever hope to have a fruitful discussion of controversial issues. In addition to loving one another and having each other's best interests at heart, we need to love the truth in every area of life. When an issue gets politicized, as they so frequently do, both sides of the issue have their spin machines. And it's a nasty fact of human nature that we all tend to believe what we want to believe. We grasp at things that confirm what we already believe, and then we use them as supporting evidence to believe what we believe more strongly. But if you receive the love of the truth, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, if you receive the love of truth, then you will try to separate truth from falsehood, no matter what it does to your arguments or your previous sermon outlines. You'll be careful about your conclusions, you'll be fair with the evidence, and sometimes you'll see that something you'd like to believe is black and white really might have a little gray in it. You'll still have strongly held convictions, but you'll be able to dispassionately discuss with those outside of your own echo chamber, and you can lovingly give them fact after fact because you will have informed yourself. You won't agree with each other on everything, ever. But you'll be helped in your understanding of one another. And you won't say it not a brother for which Christ died. Your brothers and sisters in Christ. You don't have to agree on who the president should be. My personal convictions are probably as strong as anybody's here. But I need to keep them in perspective. Just love each other anyway. You can do that. Discuss if you can do so constructively. Listen to each other. Often our convictions have deep emotional roots, just looking for some intellectual arguments to foster them. Love each other anyway. It's a good exercise in forbearance. Take care of each other's test cases to see whether you're able to love as the Bible so clearly instructs us that we must. It's not optional. Sometimes there will be some things that you just can't discuss together for a while. You know, when I was growing up, my sister and I never agreed on anything intentionally. Once in a while we accidentally agreed on something. Still, there was never any question of what we were in the same family and we loved each other. Just remember that the church is bigger than politics. We need to especially remember that every 4 years and maybe especially this year during this time. This at its bottom is an assignment about change. We can all testify that change is inevitable. Change is continually. You don't even have to be very old before you become aware of cultural change. It doesn't surprise us that there have been many changes over the past 4 decades. I was asked to talk about 40 years because it's the 40th camp out, but I do hope it's all right for me to keep going back a little further than that. I was baptized into Christ more than 60 years ago. I've been serving as an evangelist for about half a century. And I just don't view change itself as necessarily bad or good. I know it's often unsettling to people, but I don't see it as bad or good in and of itself. Every generation experiences changes which cause the elderly to look back with favor to the good old days. We say that as older people, but I know an awful lot of older people, and some of them are in this room right now, who would strongly resist having their cell phones removed from them. Because that change was something they don't want to ever predict now. It's something they would not want to lose. But lately, it does seem in our society that the rate of change has picked up speed. Secular humanism, a philosophy that's been around forever, has come really out of the woodwork more and more in the past 2 years. It espouses behavior without belief in or guidance from any kind of deity. And this has obviously had an adverse effect on our world and on the church. Because with God out of the way, and with humanity viewed as the ultimate authority, there's just no limit to the decline in societal values and moralities. Standards get to the place where they're based on majority rule or on the current thoughts of people in positions of power or influence. This is what I call sociological law. There's no mooring to it, and it can change with the wind. And we've seen that happen even in the past 5 years or so. One of the most disturbing changes, of course, is the displacement of the intact family, of a married father and mother as the preferred ideal home arrangement. Easy divorce and so-called alternative lifestyles have left children without the guidance that they need. Social acceptance of fornication, adultery, and homosexuality, and their public and pornographic portrayal has increased. The entertainment industry normalizes these sins. The Bible and those who speak against these sins are maligned in the media and in the courts of public opinion. Intentional abortion, once a crime in our nation, is now claimed as a right. Kristi Noem, governor of South Dakota, is maligned for shooting a dog that killed a neighbor's chickens and dead people. But many of the same people who are so appalled at the shooting of that dog are perfectly fine to kill unborn human beings right up to the moment of birth. In the church, of course, things always could be better. Obviously, we continually fall short of our own ideals. Personally, I still believe that we ought to have a congregation in every little town, or at least in every county seat. And I have a hard time understanding why it seems so difficult not only to bring that to reality, but often even to keep our own existing congregations going. But let me caution you when we start thinking that way, which I sometimes think, that perfectionism is really a hindrance to progress. If you're not careful, The abstract best becomes the enemy of the concrete good, and I just see so much good happening in the church that I'm filled with optimism for the future of the church. I have seen so many of our young people, some of whom are here tonight, develop into fine young men and women from godly families and born new godly families and carry on the traditions handed down to us by the Lord's apostles for the church. Yes, some fall away. That's always been the case, and it always will be. But many adhere, and I have every confidence will continue to persevere no matter what the world throws at them. How these families of committed Christians will continue to evolve elders, deacons, and evangelists to help the church. Social media has changed relationships. People who used to talk to each other once a year are now asking each other, what did you do today? But the Old Testament said, I remember, that they that love the Lord spake often with one another. And there's a lot of that going on, I think, mostly for the good. Those of us who are older sometimes say, I hear this constantly, and I say it myself, that we need to think of what our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren may have to face in such times as may come over the next few years. I understand and I share that feeling. But I also believe that when you look at that little boy crawling around on the floor tonight, we should not only think, oh, I hate to think what he had to face, but we should also think, maybe this is the time that God designed him for. When you see that little girl playing with her doll, think like Mordecai or Esther. Maybe she was born for just such a time as this. And then help to equip that child to become what the Lord wants her to be. It's no accident that you and I live in an era in which sinners' hostility toward biblical truth is now fully manifest. When the culture rejects all residual vestiges of biblical morality and embodies the enthusiastic unbelief of Romans chapter 1, we have to recognize that we're here for a purpose. We were chosen for this very era of church history, you and I. We wouldn't be here if we weren't. We are set aside for the work of God and his kingdom amidst this age of corruption. Even Corinth needed a congregation. And our towns and cities need them perhaps more than ostensibly in the past. We were chosen for this. I remember Vic Gibson. He was probably not known to many of you now, but he used to be that many people in the churches knew him. He was one of my elders when I was first baptized into Christ at an early age. And he's the elder who gave to me the right hand of fellowship on behalf of my home congregation. I remember him standing in front of me. I remember exactly where we were in the auditorium. And he told me how concerned he was over what I might have to face during my lifetime, what my generation would face. To some extent, I think this goes with the territory of being old and loving the young. Nevertheless, we have seen a noticeable acceleration in just the past few years of forces which seem hell-bent on destroying every last vestige of our Judeo-Christian heritage. And this, to some of us, gets concerning. The assigners of the topic tonight have mentioned a few specific areas on which it might be good to talk about present day versus 40 years ago. One of them is mutual edification. We've never done mutual edification as well as we should. We've never done it as well as we could. And yet, in many places, I think we're doing very well indeed with our mutual edification. And the reason that happens in those places is that somehow, and I know that elders working sometimes behind the scenes have helped to foster this, somehow, in those congregations, a culture has been established in those places where the men of the congregation are held to an expected standard of excellence. They are to the place where they don't want to let the church down, they don't want to let each other down, and they would feel it was inexcusable to let the Lord down. I was at Section Kansas a few days ago where a brother is really working very hard on his teaching, and it shows. He's obviously putting in a great deal of time and effort. If I mentioned his name tonight, I don't think anybody here would know him except the people from Section. But he's doing what we need to do, what all us men need to do, putting in the time and effort to make it work, make it palatable for the church. so that we can get the word of God across. That's what it takes. Very few of you know this man, but there are many, many like him, and I wish there were more. I'm asking about the area of church discipline. This has always been an issue, of course, but I'm not sure we're any worse at it than we were 40 years ago. In many places, I think we're doing very well with it, at least as well as we were 40 years ago, maybe even a little better. I was asked about the area of evangelism. Well, from the way I hear it, there are always lots of conversations going on. In fact, I had another conversation just back by the door as I came in tonight about a man talking about conversation. This is in the context of my invitation this morning about John chapter 3 and people thinking that that has to do with physical birth. We just had a conversation. He's talking about conversations that he's having with people in the world. And he knows what it is they say and how often that comes up. I hear this just continually, often several times a day, that there are these conversations happening, lots of Bible studies going on, lots of attempts at Bible study. Obviously, there's a lot of stony ground around in America, and it's more difficult than it used to be to convert people. When I was first an evangelist, it was easier to convert people than it is now. It was easier to start new congregations than it is now. And generally, it's harder to convert people than it used to be. But so many of the brethren are evangelistically minded and are behaving in an evangelistic manner. There's always an ongoing effort to find a method or approach to evangelism that will be more effective. And I've told a number of people that if you find something that works better, we'll all do it because that's what we all want. But it's just difficult over time. And also it's hard to help people stay converted after we baptize them. It takes a lot of time and attention. It takes a lot of sacrifice on the part of mature Christians. And there is a lot of disappointment. But remember this, even when people leave after a while with us, in general, they know where to come back to at the future time in their life when they want to come back. So it's not in vain. Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. I am asked about a cappella singing. Well, maybe I'm missing it, but I just don't see any big push to add anything instrumental or mechanical or technological to our singing. I think a very substantial number of the brethren well understand that we don't have any commandment for anything more, we don't have any example of anything more, and that history itself is on the side of singing only for the church. And the Bible students of all ages have concluded that the Lord's way is a cappella singing. And that the very spirit of simplicity in worship argues for a cappella singing. And that adding anything to that would be divisive. And that once you start down that road, there's no stopping place. I think this is well understood among the brethren. So I'm not sure why that was in the list, but you may know something that I don't. I'm asking about divorce and remarriage. This has always been an issue that's fraught with a lot of emotionality for obvious reasons. But over the past few decades, it's true that in our society, and therefore in the church, divorce has lost much of its ability to shock. It has lost much of its stigma. We do have more divorce and remarriage for any reason than we used to, while the Bible has not changed. But to be clear, the Lord allowed only one reason for divorce with a right to remarry. The Apostle Paul did not give an extra reason. If he had, he would have been contradicting the Lord, who said there is only one reason. 1 Corinthians 7:15 says nothing about divorce or remarry. And I want to state especially and succinctly for our young, that those who divorce and remarry without the right stated by the Lord do so at their own peril, no matter what the church allows. I'm asking about the issue of Bible knowledge. Well, I think it's better now than it was when I was young, for sure. The sermons are better now. The classes are better now. I think really probably exponentially better. We used to be not really all that great at that. I could give you examples that probably should not. I think our Bible knowledge probably now as a people is better than it has been during my lifetime. We have more tools at our disposal to help with the process, including additional good translations that we didn't used to have. And we have many brethren, especially since the advent of personal computers and of being able to do it on their phones, who are continually availing themselves of the possibilities of learning and who are helping each other along the way, iron sharpening iron. So I feel good about the level of Bible knowledge. Of course it could be better, but I think we're doing much better at that than we used to. I'm asked about the role of women. I am a great admirer of our women, and personally, I just don't see any push among them to get out of their place. I see them as being supportive of their husbands and children. There's an awful lot of good being done behind the scenes, where the older women are teaching the younger women, both formally and informally, and maybe sometimes the informal aspect of that becomes the most important part. You know, in the second chapter of the book of Titus, Titus was told how to handle all the groups and the congregations that he had in charge of. But the younger women were the only group that Titus was not told to teach directly, because what does he know about being a young woman? He knew nothing about it personally, but the older women know. The older women remember, so he said, "Have you got the younger women teach the younger women?" That works out very well. We've got a lot of people that are doing it. It could be happening just virtually right under your nose, and you might not realize it, but I know that it's happening a lot. So I feel good about the role of women among us. I'm asked about the appointment of officers. Obviously, in many places, it's not as easy to find men to serve as officers as it used to be, but in many other places, there is an abundant profusion of good men coming on and taking the responsibility. I assist congregations with this frequently, and I'm sure other evangelists do as well. So, while I wish it was better, I do think that we're doing reasonably well on that, at least in a great many places. So, summing this up, I'll just say again, that I stand before you tonight absolutely optimistic about the future of the church over the next 4 years. And by the way, you who are younger, and you will see if the Lord tarries the year 2064, I think we'll all be amazed how quickly you got there when that year happened. Bill Cooper and I were talking a little earlier today about how recent 1984 seems to us. The same thing is going to be true of you when you get to 2064. You'll see, you'll be wondering, where did it go? It really is like a vapor that appears from time and then vanishes away. I stand before you optimistic because we serve a God who has promised that his kingdom shall stand forever, period. It shall not be left to other people, but it shall stand forever. So I know it's going to survive. And in addition to that, I know a lot of young people, and by young I mean from the teens up into the 50s. My definition of young keeps expanding. I know a lot of younger people who I believe are demonstrating a great deal of faith and stability in their Christian walk. I see a lot of conviction, I see a lot of strength there, and I believe that they will carry on come what may. If we were at the campground, I would point at a particular tree, because over by that tree, a few decades ago, I think this was either late 80s, possibly very early 90s, I said to Richard Riggins when I just happened to come upon him, because I had been facing some issues and some unsettling things had been happening in my work at that time, I said to Richard Riggins, "Richard, I hope your generation lives a long time, because I'm not sure what's going to happen when you older guys are gone." And Richard just looked at me, I won't say with disdain, but he looked at me with those piercing eyes that many of you can recognize and remember. And he said, as though it was the most obvious thing in the world, "Well, the young men will just have to grow strong in the war, that's all." And I instantly knew he was right. It was the most obvious thing in the world, doubt. But now I have seen it happen. I've lived long enough to see it happening, and I feel good about it. Sometimes a boy becomes a man when a man is needed. My favorite president is Abraham Lincoln. I think he was our best president, a strikingly effective president. But he became what he became in the crucible of life, including that Civil War. I've seen a lot of growth in our younger people, many of whom are here tonight. And this makes me optimistic about the future on the human level, while the Lord makes me optimistic by the promises he gave for the church. I like the fact that we don't seem to have anybody among us now who wants to run everything. And that has not always been the case in the past. We have faced issues over that back in previous decades. And I want to tell you, this will be a reiteration, because I said this at the first camp out in 1984. I want to tell you that if we do ever again have somebody who seems to want to run with everything. You just need to not take them so seriously. You need to laugh at those with that type of authoritarian personality and help them not to take themselves so seriously. Because the authoritarian personality, if connected with ability, can do a lot of damage. And in the past, the brethren have made people into personalities of accumulated power because they wanted a champion. They wanted a brotherhood leader. And later they paid a heavy price for that. One farmer from North Missouri told me during those years that he had moved to Kansas City from a farm in North Missouri. And he came to a congregation in Kansas City, and everybody in the congregation was asking, which side are you on? He said, well, I didn't even know what the sides were. I was just off the farm. Well, which side are you on? It was a time of great unrest. It was a time of a lot of suspicion, a lot of sniping. I was too young to bear the full brunt of that. But a lot of people just a few years older than I was were carried away into all kinds of other religious institutions or just to decades of religious wandering and were lost to the Lord's church forever. It took us as a people a long time to get past the bitterness, past the suspicion, past the heartache experienced during those years. I could again tell the story. But I just want to reiterate the Babcock poem again called Be Strong, because I think this sums up what I want to say to you tonight. Be strong. We are not here to play, to dream, to grip. We have hard work to do and woes to lift. Shun not the struggle. Face it. It is God's gift. Be strong. It matters not how deep entrenched the wrong, how hard the battle goes, the day how long. Faint not, fight on. Tomorrow comes the song. Viktor Frankl in a Nazi concentration camp found that the Nazis ruled every aspect of his life except for one thing. Every day, Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychiatrist, said, every day I've got to choose my own attitude for the day. They couldn't take that away from me. And that's true of us as well. In the next 40 years, this will be very important to remember. That every day we choose our own attitude. We're not a perfect people, but we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission is to feed the spiritually hungry, to house the spiritually homeless, to clothe the spiritually naked, to teach the biblically illiterate. There is the call of conscience which we each must heed. Time is neutral and does not change things. But with courage and initiative, we can change whatever things need change. No generation can choose the age or circumstance in which it's born. But we can choose to make our time an age of enlightenment and an age of hope. Leadership can part the waters of doubt and point us in the direction of the promised land. I've seen so many graduates serve as examples of pouring out their soul, offering their services, and heeding the call of duty to help the church. And I expect many of you in the future to continue the same in your seed. I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet, but I know that what happens politically is far less important than our attitude about our Christian calling and our action as a result. In the fourth chapter of the book of Acts, Peter and Paul, as you're familiar, Peter and John, in the fourth chapter of the book of Acts, were put in a basket of decorum. And many of us feel that we're being put in that basket or about to be put in that same basket in our time. And we recognize that the equivalent of the Sanhedrin in our time has got surveillance techniques that Hitler and Stalin have given their IT for. And so it seems like an almost insuperable challenge at times. We don't know what we'll face, but that makes it interesting. What the Lord said to his apostle is, stand, and having done all, stand. Just a simple sentence sums it all up. That's all we have to do. To compromise with lies for the sake of a peaceful life is condemned to the need to death. We may in the future need to learn to live with reduced expectations of worldly success. You and I have a Bible that does not change. And truth outweighs the whole world. Defend the truth and endure the consequences. Yes, we do have to assess which fights are worth having, and no, prudence is not always the same thing as cowardice. But if you cannot imagine any situation where you would stand up and speak the truth and let the chips fall where they may, then cowardice has a greater claim on you than it should. The political religion that murdered tens of millions of people in the 20th century is being romanticized by ignorant and evil people in our country, in our time. The falsification of history creates suckers for false utopian promises. So how does the church fit into this picture? How does the church fit into the scene that's passing before our eyes in our country? The Lord built the church as a community that just keeps on telling the truth, no matter what. We keep on telling the truth internally, we keep on telling the truth externally, we keep on telling the truth here, there, and everywhere. The church is a space where the real meaning of words is preserved. The church is a place where we describe reality as it is. The church is a place where we show what a normal, monogamous family looks like, and we proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. In the church, people with deficient nuclear families, and there are so many of them in our time. In the church, people with deficient nuclear families can still have God's family with all its benefits and blessings. Christian parents must serve as servants of Christ and be aware that the family does not exist for itself alone, but first for God. We must teach our children how to read the world around them and how to understand people and events in terms of right and wrong. We must give our children an opportunity to serve something greater than themselves and expose them to things that help them know the difference between truth and falsehood. We must vaccinate our children against lies. We must show them that it's okay to be different. We must teach them that there is a good God who will eventually win, though it may not be seen during our earthly lifetimes. We must teach them that suffering is not meaningless because we're part of a greater path. We must teach them what to live for. We must teach them that they are accountable to God. It may well be that the demands placed on us in the future will grow greater, and that the consequences for failing to submit to government will grow more severe. Because the Christian faith is a rival religion to a post-Christian totalitarian world, and a post-Christian totalitarian world will not willingly tolerate the Christian faith for long. So totalitarianism, if it comes to America, we'll try to break down the family and break down the church. Indeed, that battle is already being fought. Because it's in the family and in the church where we get the strength to be able to fight. We help one another to have the courage that we need. And sometimes when you see somebody else behaving courageously, that pushes you over the line to behave courageously yourself. The willingness of the martyrs in the early centuries, those 10 waves of Roman persecution before Constantine, the willingness of those martyrs to suffer, even unto death, always planted in the hearts of people who saw it, the love of God, at least in some of those hearts. This is why when Tertullian said in our early years that the blood of the martyrs became the seed of the church. And we could face a time like that again. If you suffer for truth, that somehow makes truth seem more credible to others. If we share in his suffering here, we'll share in his glory in the next 40. So tonight, as we consider the next 40 years, and even a guy like me plans to be with you for a little piece of the next 40 years, each one of us has to ask ourselves, which is going to win in me? Fear or courage? Am I just an admirer of Christ, or am I really a disciple of Christ? The Lord gives you a reason to die, which is to say, he gives you a reason to live. And there can be nothing more beautiful than to lay down your life for God. Napoleon said that, why shouldn't these soldiers die for me in battle at the age of 30, then wait to die of cancer at the age of 70? And I sort of look at us that way in the church, for a much higher calling than us. Why shouldn't we die for our faith? It may come to that. I don't say that it will. I just don't know. But we need to be prepared long before the bow is drawn against us, and indeed is being drawn at this present time. This is an army, and an army fights before they get prepared to fight. And we need to be prepared to fight no matter what the cost may be. As long as we have that mindset, as long as we choose that attitude, and we do this not only individually, but there is a sense of that is a collective attitude among us. There's nothing the world can throw at us that's going to take us away from our Father's hand. They can't do it. Greater is He that is in you than He that is in the world. We can win. We can win. We've come this far and we can win. And by the grace of God, we will and we'll help one another to win. The invitation is extended to you tonight as we stand, and Mike is going to leave us in one more song.